You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to my guest, Ray Martin. I think you are going to love this story. And part of the reason I think that is that there's a bit of Ray's experience that I share today, that we share with you today, that reminds me a little bit of a blockbuster movie script from many years ago. Hold on to that thought while you listen, because after you listen, I'm super curious if you have the same thought that I do. So just share with me, like look me up, send me a message on any platform and let me know if it reminds you of a movie. And if so, what movie you think I might've been thinking of as I share this with you. That'll be fun. Ray and I talk about how a 6-month sabbatical turned into a 14-year backpacking experience that changed his life. We talk about why he went on the first sabbatical at all. And I ask him how he paid for all of these things. Also, I happen to be very proud of myself in this interview. It turns out that Ray has run a few marathons and it comes up in the conversation. If you're new to the show, you may not know this about me, but I am a runner and sometimes I go completely off track when somebody will mention that they also run or do triathlons. And I'm like, oh, me too. Let's talk about that forever and ever. I'm clearly growing up. I resist the temptation to do that in this interview. I did talk to him about it after we were done. Yay me. All right. Now, are you ready? Are you ready to meet Ray? I'm ready. Let's do it. Ray Martin, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am, Amy. Thanks for having me on your program.
I'm so happy you're here. I start every interview by asking people what part of the world they call home. And I am excited to ask you this because I know you have the accent, but where are you today?
Yeah, I'm obviously in England, about on the edge of London. There's a small town called Leighton Buzzard, and I'm located very close to there today.
Leighton Buzzard. That's a great name. That is a great name. Fantastic. All right. So in a second, we're going to get to the topic of the day, but I'm going to ask one more warm-up question. And the question I've been going with lately is, what's something that you do to take care of yourself? Something that could be called self-care.
Yeah, that's very easy to answer. I sit in meditation for 20 minutes every morning before I start my day.
20 minutes of meditation. So when you say meditation, are you doing solo silent meditation or are you solo silent? You're a better meditator than I am. I can do about 3 minutes of solo silent, but I rely heavily on guided meditations because otherwise I do this a lot. I like open my eyes and I'm like, 3 minutes. That's
enough. Okay. I like those occasionally too. They're pretty good. Some of those guided ones.
Yeah. And it gives me just enough to keep me going. So that is very good. And I don't do it every day. I should do it more often. I do what I do every day. I do movement. So I tell myself it's moving meditation. So there we go. All right. The topic of the day is that we're going to talk about how what was supposed to be for you a 6-month sabbatical turned into a 14-year journey that was life-changing. And that sounds to me like an amazing story. And I think a great question for me to start with for the beginning and for the listeners who are there is, can you take us back to before this happened? What was life like for you before you even went on the sabbatical? What were you doing for a job? How old were you? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, I can. I would describe myself as a typical mainstreamer.
You know, mainstreamer, okay.
When I was at school, the only road to happiness that I understood, which I've been told by my parents and teachers, was you get a really good job, you get a wife, you get a house, you have kids. Yeah. That's all of that equals happiness.
Yeah, so in the States, we call that the American dream. Do they have call it? When you grow up in the UK, what do they call it?
Yeah, not the American dream, but
exactly.
I don't know what the name for it was, but that's what everyone said. That's the way.
Okay. So,
and I never questioned it. I wasn't even aware enough about my thoughts about that to question it. Just followed it. So by the time I got to my mid-30s, I was ready to launch a business of my own because someone had said to me, you'll never get wealthy working as an employee for somebody. Sure. You know, if you want to seriously do okay financially, you've got to start your own business. And I was in a relationship with someone who had talents and vision in the same area that I did. And so as a couple, the two of us decided to launch our own consulting firm. And we built that up over a period of years very successfully. And in 2002, we've got this newspaper in England called the Daily Telegraph. It's a bit like the New York Times or something. And they chose me as the business leader of the year in England,
Wow.
having built this company. So I had, you know, all the boxes ticked. I was successful on paper, had all the things that equal happiness, etc. But you know, the bizarre thing is, Amy, that throughout that period, I was never really happy, and I could never figure it out. I was just always in my quietest moments going, how come I've ended up where it all looks great to
Yeah.
everyone else, but it doesn't feel great to me? And then I never resolved that until one day the woman I was married to, who was my business partner, came back from a business meeting and said, I'm leaving you and I'm leaving the company. And it was really sudden and unannounced.
Wow.
Didn't see it coming. It was a real shock. I mean, it really was probably one of the most shocking things I've experienced in my life so far. And at the same time that happened, my father got very, very ill and he died shortly afterwards. So within 3 or 4 months of the life I knew as normal, I was out of my house, out of my marriage. My dad had gone. My company was going to change. It was like literally like someone had put a set of explosive charges around my life and pressed the detonator handle, and it all just blown up.
Yes.
And I
So,
was
I mean,
standing in a big bomb crater of rubble, you know, looking at all this destroyed life.
that really is a many of the things. So, what happened? So, your marriage, and your relationship that dissolved. So, that's a huge part. You moved out of where you were living, partly because of the relationship. But that's another thing. One of the foundational element relationships of your childhood, your relationship with your father, that shifted. That's three like crisis level events in your life. Did you keep the company, or did the separation of the marriage mean that the company also dissolved?
The company eventually got sold to somebody who wanted
Okay.
to take it to the next stage of its life. I energetically, it was over for me when my ex-wife decided she wanted out, because
Okay.
it had been a sort of joyful creation out of the love we had for what we were doing. And I didn't feel it was ever going to be the same with a different business partner who wasn't someone I was in, you know, at the heart level engaged with.
Oh my goodness, that's so much change so fast, Ray. So this
So I was,
happens.
I was down on the floor. I mean, I was literally, I felt like a broken person. I never thought I'd ever be happy again. I really felt like life was over. I was like 44 years old, and I thought,
So
that's it.
44 years old. What was your so you had to move out of the house that you lived in with your partner. Where did you move? Did you move to like a small apartment? Like what was
I stayed with a friend in an apartment for a while, and then I went back into the house after my ex-wife had left to get it sold and things like that.
So sleeping on the couch or in the guest room of a friend.
Life was just weird for a while.
What did that? So take me back to that. Like sleeping on the couch of a friend. You had been named a successful adult. You had the accolades. Like many people chase the accolades, having somebody else tell us that we've hit success. You had that. A newspaper came and is like, "You are successful, Ray Martin." And fast
Gosh.
forward,
I even
and
had
you're
people
sleeping
phoning
with
me up, asking me to help them be better leaders, you know.
better leaders. And then fast forward, and you're staying as a guest on your friend in his guest room or on his couch. What did that feel like at like 9 o'clock at night when you're sitting in a house that isn't yours? If you
Oh,
had to
horrible.
describe that in a couple of words, what would you do today with some distance on it?
It was horrible. I cried myself to sleep most nights. I had a very understanding friend who knew my ex-wife as well, and so he was fantastic to me for a while. And then it was just awful, pretty
Just
awful.
awful. Just,
R
yeah.
really the lowest point of my life, I'd say.
Oh my
And
goodness.
that is why people who cared about me started to make suggestions like, why don't you take a sabbatical for a few months?
Oh, so that's how the sabbatical idea came from. It didn't bubble up from inside you. Somebody came and said, "What about this?"
No, the first time someone suggested it, I just looked at them and said, that's a stupid idea. I'd never do it. Who wants to waste their life backpacking around the world, you know?
So, and
Because,
also backpacking, we think of it. So you're in your mid-40s when this is bouncing around your head. Backpacking around Europe, I think of that as more something that people do when they are 17,
That's right.
25.
We call it a gap year in England. When you finish school and you go, before you go to university, you have a gap year. Most people go and travel that year.
We also call it a gap year
Right.
after
Okay.
in the UK, but it because we are so committed to working hard
Yeah.
in the United States, most people don't do it.
Yeah.
And so it's this whole pressure of it's catching on. It just depends on where it is, but we have a very cultural sensation that if you don't do things right now, you're never going to come back and do them, which puts a lot of pressure on our youngsters, not
Yeah.
necessarily in a good way. But the all right, so the idea of a sabbatical bubbles up from your friends.
Yep.
You initially think that it's crazy, you're never gonna do it.
Yep.
And how does that shift? How does that shift and become something that you begin to plan? And how long does that take?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I mean, it is quite hard to believe, but this is really what happened. I was so depressed and broken from what was going on. Another friend gave me some advice at the same time and said, if you're really in a dark place and you can't see a way out, one of the things you can do is find someone who really, really needs help and just focus 100% of your attention and energy on helping them for a while and just put your own troubles to one side and just focus on that person. And generally, when you do that, something will emerge, some crack in your reality will emerge by taking your attention completely off of it for a while. And I thought, actually, that's a pretty good bit of advice. And I'd had heard through my grapevine of friends that someone I knew lived in Australia with her husband and very young son had breast cancer. So I reached out to her and I said, is that true? She said, yeah. I said, and she told me she was about to go for chemotherapy, et cetera. I said, how would you feel if I came out to Australia for a month and just took care of you and Matt and Pete and just was generally there to help and support? She said, oh, that would be great. Please come. Please come.
Wow.
So I did that. And I stayed for about 3.5 weeks with them. Nothing changed. I was still in the same funk. And then I was thinking, oh, that bloody bit of advice. It wasn't that good. And nothing. It's exactly the same. I'll tell you, it did shift. But I realized that within that advice, there's nothing to do with how long it takes until the new.
Sure.
Someone said it was going to be immediate.
Yep.
So I had a week left and I went to Cairns in Australia to see another friend because it's such a long way from England that I thought I better see friends while I'm here.
Yes.
When I day the day I arrived, she said, we're just getting tickets to see a play at the theatre tomorrow night. Do you want one? Because you can come with us. I said, yeah, okay. So we're at the theatre the next night watching this play. And in the interval, I saw an ad in the programme with all the details, saying we're going to audition for the next play here at this theatre. It's about a British member of parliament. It's called Out of Order. It's a very famous play. It's a comedy. And we're inviting actors to come and audition for it. And I turned to my friends, completely joking, and said, I should audition for that because I've got the perfect English accent to play a member of parliament. That would be great. And I thought they'd just laugh, but they actually looked at me quite seriously and said, well, we know the director of the play. Why don't you go to the audition? You're here on Sunday. I said, oh, don't be ridiculous. I'm leaving on Tuesday and I'm not an actor. I'm never going to get a part. And I, no, silly idea. They said, well, why don't you just do it for fun? I said, okay, I'll do it for fun. And I did go, flew back to England. The day I arrived, my friend Julie, who put me up to this audition, she said, we've had a call from the director of the play. They really, really want you to be in the play. And I said, well, what part? Because I can't afford to come back for 3 months. I've got all this work to do, mortgage to pay. They said they want you to play the lead role in the play, George Picton. It's like 400 lines a night in the script. It's the central comedic character of the whole play. They want you to play him. So I quickly got a copy of the script from a theatre shop in London. My brother's wife is an actress, so I showed it to her and I said, do you think someone with my experience, i.e. none, could sort of somehow do this? She said, yeah, I think you could. I could help you. I definitely think you could. And I then called the director of the play from London and said, are you crazy wanting me to do this? You know, I've got no experience. You've got 400 paying customers every night coming in for their tickets. And are you sure you think I could handle this? They said, we think you'd be great. We'll guide you. We'll get you ready. We know you could do it. We really want you to do it. So I needed what I call a confirmation signal that this was the right decision because I sort of felt, honestly, Amy, that God was calling me to do it. It was a weird feeling. It was beyond just a good idea. I sort of felt there was some destiny involved in this. And so I thought, what's the confirmation signal that I need? So I'd got back from Australia to help three or four clients that had booked commitments with me to do work with them. And I needed money to pay for my life. And I called each one and I just thought, I'll be truthful with them. I told them this story exactly as I'm telling it now. I said, I really feel I'm being called to do this. I want to go back and do it, but I promised you I would be here to do this work with you. So if you say you want me to stay and do this work, I will put that first and I won't go. I'll only go if you give me your full unconditional blessing to do it. And I'll see you when I get back. And all of them said, I give you my blessing. I would definitely do it if I was you. All of them. So I knew that this was my confirmation signal.
Wow.
And so I then flew back to Australia 2 days later and I acted in the play. It was splendid. I got reviews in all the newspapers. It was just a life-changing experience. I still didn't have any new insight about the rest of my life. But as I was flying home from Australia after the play, I noticed I had this feeling of dread in my body in the aeroplane, thinking, oh, I'm going back to be Ray the businessman in London again now. And that doesn't feel so great with all the troubles that he has in his life. And then I thought, hang on a minute. I had this massive epiphany. I thought, Ray the businessman is just a character like George Pigden, who I learned how to play. I learned how he walked, how he dressed, how he sounded. Ray the businessman is just a character I've been playing for 20 years without consciously realizing it's not me. I can change that character or drop it or write him out of the series. I can just kill that off. And so when I got back to England, I decided to sell my house and close the company and sell it and get out.
All right. That was one of my questions, like when I was thinking about how this would have shaken out and how you ended up doing a sabbatical. Because I think that one of the things that keeps people from making big changes as adults is that we get enmeshed with our requirements. So like when you're, you know, when you're 18 and you don't have anything, there's nothing, you don't need much money. It doesn't cost much to run your life. And then we build all these entrapments that are very comfortable and they're not bad, but you know, it's like, there's a limit where it's like, you know, so you have to do these things. So you come back. So how long was the run in Australia? How many shows did you do?
About 12 over 2 weeks.
2 weeks. And then that is an amazing story. And it does feel like, I mean, people have different ways of thinking how these things work out, but you, like, you know, it started with a little blip of an idea and then you took a little bit of action, you tried it, and then, you know, you got the job and your friends told you and all of these things, it was lining up like it was destined to be. I can see how it feel like a calling. How long is this after the period of the minds exploding in your life? Like, how far out are you from the big explosions that happened, like your wife leaving you and stuff?
Yeah. We physically separated our lives, or began that process, in October of 2003, October 2003. And I went to Australia in April of 2005.
Okay. So it's about 2 years after that is when.
About a year and a half. Yeah. About 18
year and
months,
a half. Yeah. So about a year and a half. And then you begin the process of, you know, divesting yourself of your, of the things, the house, the job, all of this stuff.
I mean, I'll tell you, I just knew that I was going through a process of getting my life into alignment with what's true for me. That's all I could describe it as. I just stopped doing stuff that was, as Bronnie Ware said in her book, The Top Five Regrets of the Dying, which is the book that's probably had the greatest impact on me ever. She said, the top regret that everyone has when they die is, I wished I'd lived my life true to myself and not the life that others expected of me. And I look back at my life and everything I was doing was what others expected of me. And I was really good at it. That was the weird thing.
Yeah.
But I just didn't like it that much. And so I thought, I've got to stop this. I'm going to stop this. I'm going to do what I want to do, not what others expect of me. And so
I think that your experience is highlighting a missing piece of how a lot of people experience this.
Yeah.
When you had to actually get so far away from your existing life.
Yes.
To be able to even see and feel that it was not in alignment. If we had asked you before your wife had walked out, you had maybe a sense of malaise.
Yeah.
An uncertainty, but not enough to pull the trigger because you didn't have any way to highlight what was going on.
I love what you just said, Amy. And I remember, because I was getting these confirmation signals from the clients, say, go and do it. And then at the time, I read this quote And I thought, wow, that's the icing on the cake. Because the quote said something like, a man cannot discover new oceans unless he has the courage to lose sight of the shore.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's a good one. I have a lot of those little things that reaffirm that idea, 'cause when you are comfortable, it is hard to see that. But it's like, the ship is not meant to stay in the harbor, that kind of thing. It's like, but it's easier in the harbor when you're at the dock. That's where the easy things are. And I think that's also why people have the big epiphanies about happiness and unhappiness when they travel on vacation. But they can be false signals. They can be false
Yeah,
signals, and people
they
can make
can.
them, my only point here is I don't think it's as easy all the time to pick it up in the moment as we wish it was. And I think that's one of the common frustrations that a lot of people go through. It's like something is off, but I don't even know what it is. And you can be surrounded by people who are like, hey, just get in alignment. And you're like, alignment with what? What does that mean? And so, yeah.
I think that was that event, to answer the long answer to the question, that was what gave me the impetus to
Yeah.
start the sabbatical. Because when I got back to London, I put my house on the market, and within 2 months it was sold. And that gave me the job of deciding what to do with everything that was in it, because
Sure.
it was the accumulation of all the material possessions of my life. So I decided, having read the book by Ryan Nicodemus and Joshua Fields Milburn, the minimalist guys,
Oh, okay. Yes. All
I
right.
read
Very
their
good.
book and watched their documentary, and I decided I would either sell or give away everything that I owned, because I didn't want to put it into storage. Everyone who'd done that had told me they never wanted the stuff back, and they wasted tens of thousands of dollars. And so I
But the
got rid of
first month
everything.
is free. The first month is free. That's how they get you in there.
It might be, but I got rid of everything, and it left me with like a 22-kilo hold all of clothes and a laptop. That was all I had left.
Wow.
And
Okay.
I was ready then to go on a sabbatical. And I had a couple of dates in London with someone who was also wanting to travel for different reasons. And we said we'll travel together initially. So that it was all coming together really, really in an easy way. It was sort of laying itself down in front of me almost.
So
And
as you were doing this, as you were shedding the layers, getting rid of, you sell the house, you're getting rid of things. Did you have moments of uncertainty as you were doing this? Because that's a big stuff is tied to our memories and to our emotions. And, like, so was it clear that it was like, this is all very good? Or were there moments of like, ooh, I don't know.
Yeah, there were some, just in, as I was going off to sleep sometimes, I'm thinking, am I just nuts? Am I
Yeah.
throwing this all away? Am I ever going to have a life like this again? I built all
Yeah.
this up for, took so many years of hard work. Am I stupid to just let it all go? But, there was a, that's what I call my habit voice, the voice that says all that stuff. But my wisdom voice, which is coming from inside my gut, much lower down in my being, was going, Ray, you just trust this. Just trust it. You just go and do what you're being guided to do, and
All
trust it.
right.
And so I was
What
having
did
both of those voices.
that's definitely what about, and I think that's really, especially with buying and selling a house,
Oh, God, yeah.
there's often on both sides, when you buy a house and they show you how much you're going to be spending over the time, that's a gut check moment. And also when you sell a house, it's like, oh, am I ever going to, am I, is it a mistake? Am I
It
making a
was a
mistake?
beautiful house in West London. It was like one of those
Yeah.
brownstone houses in New York City. It was like, oh my God, should I let this go?
Yeah, it can be really hard. What did, and I haven't gone through exactly what you've done, so, but I it can be very, very hard, any of those changes for sure. And so as you're doing this, what are the people around you saying? Are people around you encouraging it to do you, or was there the occasional person that was like, I don't know, Ray?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mixture, to be
Yeah.
honest. Like some naysayers going, you're crazy. Why don't you just stay and carry on with the business? You put so much into it, and la
Yeah.
la la la. Other people were saying, this is the chance of a lifetime. What have you got to lose? If it all goes wrong, you can just come back and start doing what you did before. It's like there's not
Yeah.
much risk. And they were right. And the big thing for me that made it really easy is I didn't have kids when I was married.
Okay.
So I didn't have to think about their wellness or their how to look after them. I built that. That was a, just how it turned out. It was by good fortune. I didn't have them at that moment.
All right, so Is the plan at this point, you've got a friend who you've met who also wants to travel. Is it an intentional 6 month plan? Did you say to yourself, I'm going to do this for 6 months
Yeah, I
and
did.
this is and then I'm going to come back and get back to my real life?
Yeah, I did. Partly because the property market is such that if you stay out of it too long, prices go up, etc. So
Oh
I
yeah,
said,
that's
I
the you can
yeah.
sell your house, but you don't have any place to live then.
Yeah. So I said, look, I'm going to sell the house. The house did get sold. It was in a great place and lots of demand for it. And I said, I won't buy another property before I leave because I'm not quite sure exactly where I want to live. But when I get back after 6 months, I'm going to buy a smaller property and start over again. So I had the intention of doing that and maybe starting another business as well.
Right. So that
Because I
was the
thought,
familiar pattern. That's your risk container. You're like, I'm ready for 6 months. This is going to be a whim. And then I'm going to come back to what I already know works. And that gave you the confidence then to take the jump.
And I thought I'm going on a quest to find out what I'm not understanding about life, that all of this bad stuff has happened to me. And
Okay.
what's the wisdom I need to draw from it all and reflect on? I didn't quite know how that quest was going to be met, but Anthony Robbins, the coach who a lot of people know about in America, he says, the quality of your life is depending on the questions you're asking, because the word quest is, what is the quest I am on? Quest I on. That's
Okay.
how
Oh,
the translation.
question. So Anthony Robbins, Tony Robbins, he gets a lot of flack sometimes, but that is one of the things he's most famous for saying. I think it is a really, really powerful thing. It's like
Yeah, me
you
too.
look at the questions that you're asking, and sometimes putting yourself in a situation where people will push you on the questions, like when we were talking about what were your friends saying, and some of them were saying you're crazy to do this, and others were saying chance of a lifetime. And having that, the variety of questions doesn't necessarily make the decision making easier. It just means that you have different pools to figure out what feels better, like being at a buffet. Oh, do you guys do buffet where it's like you try one thing and you're like, nah, I don't like that actually very much. And then you try the other thing and you're like, oh, look at that. That's the thing I like. So I think that that's really good. So what did you do on the 6 months? Where did you go and what were some of the experiences you had?
The first place I headed to was Thailand,
Okay.
because it was a popular country for backpackers and low cost and, lots to see and do. I'd never been to Asia in my life, so I could have picked anywhere, but that's where I headed first. And just started to enjoy life without a tie, the tie of the businessman,
The cravats, yes.
but also the four ties I describe in my book, which are our life's defined by our career, our partner or spouse, our house, our actual
Yep.
home, and our community of friends and family. So
I
those
think
are the
that's,
four
yeah.
ties.
So those are the four ties.
And I had
And
none of those at all for a while.
wow. All
And
right. So.
I'd never had a life like that without those ties. I mean, it was literally virgin territory mentally.
Yeah. And okay, so you head off to Thailand literally with a backpack and a laptop. You don't have the company at any point, so you're able to just go through experiences and do that.
And to pick choose every day how it's going to be and where to go and what to do and who to hang out with,
So
et
you were
cetera, et
kind
cetera.
of like you were retired.
Well, I was only 45,
Right,
so
yeah,
I
right. But
definitely
that's why
wasn't.
when people talk about retirement, they're like, I'm going to wake up and do that. And that is one of the reasons I brought that up is because you were only 45, because one of the dangers of pushing retirement off to like 70 is that you may not be able to do the things.
Exactly. I'd read someone else's book.
Yeah.
I can never remember those, where he talked about this concept of drawing forward some of your retirement years
Yeah.
instead of waiting till you get to 68 or 70. Maybe bring 2 or 3 years of your retirement into your 40s, take a couple of years off, and then go back into work and then do it again in your 50s, etc. And I like that idea. I thought that
I
was a
think that's
brilliant idea.
very, yeah. I think that that's very good. And I think that one of the things that happens to people is that they end up with those breaks, but they're unplanned because of job security, like they'll be changing jobs or something is happening or there's an illness. And so they are taking breaks, but they're not taking breaks to have amazing experiences. They're not, they're not going on the backpacking trip. And that's not to say that everybody can. Like it's an amazingly privileged thing to be able to have done that, I'm sure, right? Like, so people, for anybody who's listening who's like, I'd love to do that and I can't because I don't have a business to divest myself of, we get it. We get it. All right. So, How then does, because that's one of the things I was going to ask you is I was like, how did you pay for this sabbatical? Like,
Well,
how
I was,
right.
yeah, I'm glad you did because a lot of people sort of think I must have had loads of money, but I'll give you, I can't remember what the actual costs were 20 years ago in London, but let's make it relative, just use relative numbers. I think the cost of my life in London with the mortgage and the cost of living there and everything was somewhere between like $5,000 or $6,000 a month that I was having to find through earning money, you know, doing work and stuff. When I was living in Asia as a modest, frugal backpacker, really living budget, I was living on $600 or $700 a month. So it
Right,
was
because you
nowhere
just didn't
near
have
as
any.
it was nowhere near as expensive. I could literally have lived 2 or 3 years on the same amount of money that would have lived 1 year in London.
Yes, 100%. And then, so then you go to Thailand, you begin to have these experiences. What would you say is it's the first time you are realizing you don't have these connections or these ties to your life? What are the first couple of epiphanies you have? Like, how are you feeling at this time?
I felt pretty anxious and scared in the first 3 or 4 months I was traveling. I was a tourist, so I was enjoying it on the surface. But inside, I was thinking, I was carrying a lot of guilt and shame about having been a failed husband and been unsuccessful in marriage. I felt a bit of a charlatan that people who really knew me would know I wasn't this successful image leader. I looked in the public sphere. And so was carrying lots of guilt and shame and feelings like that. And I realized that whilst I'd logistically altered a lot of things, I hadn't psychologically given myself what I needed in order to actually go through the transition that I was in. I read this book by William Bridges on transitions, and I learned and understood it from reading this. And so I authored, no, I didn't. That's right. I was anxious about this. And I told one or two other travelers that I'd met. And one of them said to me, "Have I considered doing a Vipassana meditation retreat?" I said, "What is that? I've never even heard of it." I didn't know what meditation was or
Haven't
Vipassana.
considered it, never heard of it.
So I said, "No." He said, "Well, you go into a monastery, Buddhist monastery for 10 days, you sit in silence and meditate with the monks, and they teach you about the Dharma, the Buddhist way of living, the philosophy that they have, and how you can apply it to your own life. And you become very, very familiar with and observant of your own mind, and it's very releasing, you know." I just felt the energy of the person describing it, and I could notice my skin tingling with a kind of excitement. And I thought, I don't understand a word they're saying really, but I feel like that's a really good idea. I'm going to do that. So I just followed that feeling, really.
Did you do that in Thailand or where did you
Yeah, I
find?
was in Thailand, so I went to Suratani where the monastery was,
And
signed up.
signed up two weeks?
10 days,
10 days. I'm very in that now the meditation makes more sense because you learned from the professionals. There are a couple of Buddhist advisors that I like will refer to, like Tara Brach, who's a
Oh,
Buddhist
yeah, she's one of my
therapist.
teachers. Yeah, she's great.
And I love her teachings, but when I offer it to other people, I say, all right, I want to also give you this that if you haven't done, I've not done a lot of Buddhist training. And I think that people who have, they are on a different level with
You might
acceptance
think
and
that, but I promise
allowing,
you it's not the
And I'm like, so give yourself some grace if she presents this
Yeah.
idea, if you hear her say, like, just let it flow. And you're like, nah, I don't know what that means, not feel it. Like she's done this for a long time.
Yes.
And so for me, it's a target, it's a goal, but that's
Yeah,
really,
she's
really
one of
impressive.
the rock stars of the meditation world, but without doubt, you know, so clearly, yeah. She's like the Taylor Swift of meditation, if there was such a thing.
No, I think she would really appreciate that moniker, and I think that we can definitely go that. All right, so you were there. I think that one of the things that led and that I'm fascinated by this is that you were able to make that connection that you had not done the transformational work internally. And I want to thank you for admitting and sharing with us that you felt the disingenuity of where you were presenting, which I, and the shame, because I think that those are pretty deep things that most people are not. Many, many people feel, and not a lot of people will admit. A lot of relationships don't last forever, and That's a thing I talk to people about all the time. And one of the things that I began to say to people many, many years ago is that I was like, people would come to me and they were like, well, I know my, divorce is not failure. And I was like, yeah, but there's a deeper layer to that, right? Like you can say that over and over again, but if you grew up with a story that marriage means success, then, and you don't unpack that, then all you're doing is banging your head against the wall, trying to convince yourself you're not a failure, right? And so, people will push back pretty hard when I present it because you don't know, you're not always aware of the story that you were told when you were young and what's holding you. Those ties that you're talking about, they're invisible. They're invisible. Yeah. And one of them, so like one of the things with your ties with relationships, you're talking about relationships, the relationship with your father, you didn't choose for that to end. Those are, that's like a process of growing up when our parents die. That's like, we don't elect for that. That happens to us.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. And so Korea. So, all right. So you're running around without a tie. You go to the Buddhist meditation. You're learning how to become an observer of your own life, which is the one of the Buddhists sitting under the tree, allowing the allowing the
It's an
thing.
essential thing. I mean,
Yeah.
maybe later, if we've got time, I'll talk about that because I see that as being one of the my six rules for happiness, which I wrote in the book. Becoming your own observer is rule number three. It's essential. You've got to
Yeah.
be able to do that.
It's one of those ideas that whenever I am reading things and picking things up from other pieces, when I find that there's an idea that sort of jumps camp, like you will find it in wildly different advice pockets. That's when I'm like, oh wow, that's probably a thing that has some merit. So like, journaling. You have people from like all different camps. They're like, it is helpful to write stuff down. That's a sign that maybe it has merit. And one of those things is allowing yourself to be an observer of your own life. And then I would break that out to, which I see you doing in your stories, allowing other people to reflect back what they see, which is, sort of the awareness that you're not always the best reporter of your own life when you listen to people. So there's a, so when does, okay, so we could talk about that all day and I'll try and remember to come back to it, but there is a limit to how long we're going to talk. So, when does a 6-month trip turn into a 14-year adventure? How does that happen?
Well, the Vipassana retreat was a life-changing, game-changing event for me. And that happened at like 5.5 months into the 6 months.
Okay.
And I left the monastery after 10 days. And if I'd had a on the side of my head a round knob, like a volume knob, it was as if someone had turned it down from a 10 out of 10 noise level in my head to like a 1 out of 10. I thought, wow, this feels, I felt like completely different mindset leaving than when I entered. And I knew there was something deeply transformational about that that I needed to pursue and understand at a deeper level. So I decided that 6 months wasn't enough, that I wasn't ready to return to start a new business and get a new home. I hadn't met the terms of my quest yet. And so I decided
You
to
have
stay on
not
and
rescued the
no.
princess from the castle,
Correct.
to
Yeah,
put it
kind
in
of.
terms of Mario,
Yeah, or the
the video
hero's
game.
journey, like Joseph Campbell. I hadn't conquered or slayed the dragon, you know,
There,
and
that's a better metaphor. When you were talking about the quest, I was thinking about the kids' video game where you rescue Princess Peach. But it is, yeah, slaying the dragon is a better example.
hadn't slayed the dragon and then acquired the new wisdom to take back to the old world and share it with.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know what to do, but I knew I needed to stay in the orbit of this mindfulness. So I moved to a place called Chiang Mai in Thailand and joined a meditation group that met every week where I could learn and meditate with people and deepen my practice. And then those people were involved in all sorts of businesses and things. And I started to get involved in some of those. And a couple of years later, I'd been to places that had really touched my heart emotionally, like, for example, an elephant sanctuary in Thailand
Yeah.
where they were rescuing elephants that had been harmed or blown up by landmines and things like that. And an orphanage in Nepal where I'd organized a picnic for about 60 orphan kids. And I started to feel a lot of desire to help these places. And I didn't know what to do. And then in my sitting with the, what should I do to help these people? As the universe does when you're asking questions, people are drawn to you just weirdly at the right time. So this guy showed up in Chiang Mai who had run six marathons, and I was 49 when I met him. And he told me about what it was like to run a marathon. And as he described it, I had a similar thing to the Vipassana. I just sat and tingled with it. Oh, God, this feels great listening to him with his marathon stories. I said to Matt, his name was, I said, Matt, do you think I could run a marathon? And he said, well, you look quite fit. Have you run before? I said, no. He said, well, I'll tell you what, I know why you want to do it, because I told him about the fundraising idea that I had. He said, if you stay here for 6 months, I'll train you how to run your first marathon. I said, okay. And I did. And I got a place, unbelievable. I got a place in the New York Marathon. It was the first marathon I ever ran.
That's a good one.
And I chose that one because a year or two before, I'd been on a short trip to New York and watched the end of the marathon in Central Park with my friend living there. And they asked me, would you want to run the New York Marathon? I said, no, I'm never going to run a marathon in my life.
Do but you see these people? Yes, they look very tired.
Yeah. I said, but if I did, I would definitely want to do this one. Yeah. This would be the only marathon I'd consider doing. So when Matt said to me, what marathon do you want to do as your first one? I said, well, the New York one. And I put my name in the ballot because there was a million people wanting a place. And I took it as a confirmation signal that that was the right choice, because a week later, I got a place first time in the ballot. You know, it was like, it was
frustrating.
Easy.
Frustrating tens of thousands of people who've been trying for a decade to get in. Yeah,
I got in straight away. I just knew that was a confirmation signal. That was always meant to be the case.
Very cool.
And so I got to New York November 1st, 2009, fully trained to run a marathon. And I'd been in touch with, I started a fundraising out organization on my own, calling people in the middle of the night, basically, and daytime all night. I raised $15,000. So after I ran that race, I then had a year and a half to go back to Asia with all that money and deploy it at the elephant sanctuary, at the orphanage, get stuff built, buy computers, buy things they needed, and get it all installed. And that took me a year and a half. So now I'm like 5 years into the journey.
Wow.
It just kept, and every time I did something, it snowballed to something else. And the other thing was always quite exciting.
Very nice.
And it just kept on, it just literally kept on snowballing like that. And eventually 14 years later, I returned to the UK at the end of a 5-year relationship that came to an end. And it was time to get back.
Time. Yeah. So that's exactly. So you brought me right to where I was. So you didn't come back at the end of 6 months, and that worked into 14 years.
Yes.
But at that time, you just were living your life,
yes,
sort of based out of Asia, following the breadcrumbs,
yes,
doing the thing that felt there. And it was when things are in alignment, I find that sometimes it can be hard for me to figure out if things are in alignment. But the signal that things are in alignment is that it feels easy. And the example I give to people is like, you know, if I want a turkey sandwich for lunch and I go into my kitchen and all of the ingredients are there, that feels really easy, right?
Yeah.
That's like an alignment. But if I want like to make paella and I don't have any of the ingredients and I'm in a town where I don't even know where the grocery store is, that feels like it's a lot of work, because it's not that the paella is a bad idea. It's just that it's not in alignment with resources I have and the knowledge and stuff like that.
Yes.
So there's a relationship then there that works. You
no
long term,
yeah,
a couple of relationships, but then you find yourself at another transition point. You end a relationship and you're like, you know what? Time to go back. Now what feels right is going back to the UK.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlapping threads here, so I'll try and simplify it. You know, it around about 2010, I collected 100 email addresses from people I'd met. Well, how did I get those? They were people I'd met and spent an evening with, just telling them stories about how I started traveling and doing the foundation and the play in Australia and everything. And a lot of them,
I love the story about the play in Australia. Yeah. That and really is a kismet story.
It is. And I've got quite a few more from this 14 years, which is why I ended up writing the book. But the thing was that everyone said to me, and this made me laugh when they said it, can I give you my email address? I say, yeah, why? They say, well, because I love the stories you've told. And if you ever write a book about it, I'd really like you to write to me and tell me. And I laughed and said, I'm not doing this to write a book. I'm doing this to heal myself, to find my quest. You know, this is for me. It's not. But one, I got to about 100 email addresses in 2010. I thought, hang on a minute. The universe wants me to write a book. It just suddenly dawned on me one day. Why do people keep asking me about this stupid book? You know, I've got to write a book. And I thought, oh, no, I don't know anything about writing a book. It's going to take me forever. I don't even know what to do. And as I was having those thoughts, literally, I saw on Facebook, which was quite new at that time, that somebody was running a 5-day writer's course in Chiang Mai, coming from New York, some big literary agent, to show people the basics of writing a book. And so I wrote to that person to get a confirmation signal. Should I do that or not? And they wanted to, it was $1,200 for the course, and it was about 5 days. But it looked to me like it was for seasoned writers, you know, people who had already written something, not novices. So I wrote to her and I said, two questions. One is, would I get in the way if I signed up for this course? Because I'm a novice. And is it really for people who've got some experience? And could I join on that basis? And then the second thing is, I can't afford $1,200. I'm doing fundraising. I'm living modestly. I've got no income. I could, you know, I could get $500 together, but could I do it for that? And she wrote back and said yes to the first one and yes to the second one. And I knew that was my confirmation signal.
Oh, wow. All
right.
That course. There's a hidden lesson in there that has come up a couple times, which I'll just draw out for the people who are listening, who are walking and running around the treadmill or wherever they are doing these things, which is that you asked.
Yeah.
And like, sometimes we feel like we're looking for confirmation. It can be hard to ask for things. But
yeah,
when you talk to people who are making things, it's like having the distance to be able to say, I'm just going to ask, and if it's confirmation, I'm not going to take it personally if they say no. So there is that. All right. So this is when you decide to write the book. You've been gone. All right. I want to be very intentional and give you a chance to directly tell people about the book and where they can find it and all the things you do these days in your life.
Well, the easiest way to find out about the book is at the website lifewithoutatie.com, because the book's called Life Without a Tie. And there's a website, lifewithoutatie.com. That's the easiest way. And the reason the website's there, to be honest, is that got evolved after the book got published, because people who read the book kept writing to me saying, can we see pictures of some of these places? Because there's no photos in the book. And so that website's got lots of photos from my actual journeys and different places and some of the people in it, et cetera, et cetera, so that people can see what it looked like.
Very good. So you write the book. How long ago did you release the book?
Oh, you're like 18 months ago. It's quite recent.
This is very new. This is very new.
Yeah.
All right. So people can find that as Life Without a Tie, T-I-E.
Yeah. It's on Amazon. So it's in bookshops, but mostly, I think in America, most people buy it on Amazon.
That we are a very Amazon-driven group of people. That's very fair. I'm going to put all those links for everybody in the show notes. So wherever you're looking for it, it'll be there on the podcast player. It'll be there on YouTube.
Yeah.
The easiest way for people who are watching and listening to get the links is always to be a subscriber to my email list at imperfectadulting.com. And then I send them direct to your inbox.
Brilliant. Amy, just let me tell you as well that if anyone wants to hear me speaking the introduction of the book, I did an audio recording, which is on that website, and it's free to download.
Perfect.
So if someone's thinking, oh, I'm not sure if I want to read the book or not, they can hear the introduction and then decide, and they don't have to.
That is a very generous offer, and I want to say thank you so much for sharing it with the audience, and I'll make sure that we mention that. All right. Ray, are you ready for the final three questions?
Yeah, I think so.
I say this so ominously, but it's really just for fun. All right. So the idea is that I just throw out this random question for you and you answer with whatever comes to mind, two or three words, right?
Okay.
If you could only eat one meal for the rest of your life, like on repeat, you only get the same thing, what would you choose?
Oh, that's easy. Steak, mushrooms, and onions.
Really? I love that you had that ready.
That's my favorite go-to
Very
meal.
Good.
That's
All right.
It.
Very good. That's a very bachelor meal. It's like steak on the grill. All right. Very good. Do you consider yourself a morning person or a late night person?
Definitely a morning person.
Morning
By the
person.
Time, late night, I'm ready to just chill. Yeah.
Very good. All right. You've done all of these things. You've had like these amazing experiences. Do you still have a bucket list or like some ideas of things that you still want to do and hope to experience? And if so, are you willing to share with us one of the things that is still out there that you want to do?
Yeah. Right now, what's coming to the top of my bucket list is I want to learn how to play the guitar.
Very nice.
Very nice.
I have no idea
how I'm going to do that, but that's one of the things that's next.
I think that's an eminently doable thing because it's like a lot of people do it. You know, you buy a guitar, you find a teacher, you mess around.
Yeah, right.
Cut your fingernails.
Yeah.
You know, that's how that goes. All right. That's it. Ray Martin, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest on the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi, again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.